dismiss the notion that this situation was largely his fault. Wolfgar didn't reply. Morik understood that the big man had not even heard his words, that his friend was already gone from this place, fallen deep within himself. Perhaps that was the best course to take. Looking at the sneering mob, hearing Jarkeld's continuing speech, watching the headless body of Creeps Sharky being dragged across the platform, Morik wished that he too could so distance himself. The magistrate again told the tale of Creeps Sharky, of how these other three had conspired to murder that most excellent man, Captain Dudermont. Jarkeld made his way over to Wolfgar. He looked at the doomed man, shook his head, then turned back to the mob, prompting a response. There came a torrent of jeers and curses.
"You are the worst of them all,"
Jarkeld yelled in the barbarian's face.
"He was your friend, and you betrayed him."
"Keelhaul him on Dudermont's own ship,"
came one anonymous demand.
"Draw and quarter him and feed him to the fishes,"
yelled another. Jarkeld turned to the crowd and lifted his hand, demanding silence, and after a bristling moment they obeyed.
"This one,"
the magistrate said,
"I believe we shall save for last."
That brought another chorus of howls.
"And what a day we shall have,"
said Jarkeld, the showman barker.
"Three remaining, and all of them refusing to confess."
"Justice," Morik whispered under his breath. Wolfgar stared straight ahead, unblinking, and only thoughts of poor Morik held him from laughing in Jarkeld's ugly old face. Did the magistrate really believe that he could do anything to Wolfgar worse than the torments of Ertu? Could Jarkeld produce Catti Bree on the stage and ravish her, then dismember her in front of Wolfgar, as Ertu had done so many times? Could he bring in an illusionary Brunner and bite through the dwarf's skull, then use the remaining portion of the dwarf's head as a bowl for brain stew? Could he inflict more physical pain upon Wolfgar than the demon who had practiced such torturing arts for millennia? At the end of it all, could Jarkeld bring Wolfgar back from the edge of death time and again so that it would begin anew? Wolfgar realized something profound and actually brightened. This was where Jarkeld and his stage paled against the abyss. He would die here. At last, he would be free. Jarkeld ran from the barbarian, skidding to a stop before Morik and grabbing the man's slender face in his strong hand, turning Morik roughly to face him.
"Do you admit your guilt?"
he screamed. Morik almost did it. Almost screamed out that he had indeed conspired to kill Dudermont. Yes, he thought, a quick plan formulating in his mind. He would admit to the conspiracy, but with the tattooed pirate only, trying to somehow save his innocent friend. His hesitation cost him the chance at that time, for Jarkeld gave a disgusted snort and snapped a backhanded blow across Morik's face, clipping the underside of the rogue's nose, a stinging technique that brought waves of pain shifting behind Morik's eyes. By the time the man blinked away his surprise and pain, Jarkeld had moved on, looming before Tiyaniknik.
"Tiyaniknik,"
the magistrate said slowly, emphasizing every syllable, his method reminding the gathering of how strange, how foreign this half-man was.
"Tell me, Tiyaniknik. What role did you play?"
The tattooed half-Quullen pirate stared straight ahead, did not blink, and did not speak. Jarkeld snapped his fingers in the air, and his assistant ran out from the side of the platform, handing Jarkeld a wooden tube. Jarkeld publicly inspected the item, showing it to the crowd.
"With this seemingly innocent pole, our painted friend here can blow forth a dart as surely as an archer can launch an arrow,"
he explained.
"And on that dart, the claw of a small cat, for instance, our painted friend can coat some of the most exquisite poisons, concoctions that can make blood leak from your eyes. Bring a fever so hot as to turn your skin the color of fire, or fill your nose and throat with enough phlegm to make every breath a forced and wretched-tasting labor, or but a sampling of his vile repertoire.
The crowd played on every word, growing more disgusted and angry. Master of the show, Jacques held measured their response and played to them, waiting for the right moment.
"Do you admit your guilt?"
Jarkel yelled suddenly in Tiernicknick's face. The tattooed pirate stared straight ahead, did not blink, and did not speak. Had he been full-blooded, Quillen, he might have cast a confusion spell at that moment, sending the magistrate stumbling away, baffled and forgetful. But Tiernicknick was not pure-blooded, and had none of the innate magical abilities of his race. He did have Quillen concentration, though, a manner, much like Wolfguard's, of removing himself from the present scene before him.
"You shall admit all,"
Jarkeld promised, wagging his finger angrily in the man's face, unaware of the pirate's heritage and discipline.
"But it will be too late."
The crowd went into a frenzy as the guards pulled the pirate free of his binding post and dragged him from one instrument of torture to another. After about half an hour of beating and whipping, pouring salt water over the wounds, even taking one of Tiernicknick's eyes with a hot poker, the pirate still showed no signs of speaking. No confession, no pleading or begging, hardly even a scream. Frustrated beyond endurance, Jarkeld went to Morik just to keep things moving. He didn't even ask the man to confess. In fact, he slapped Morik viciously and repeatedly every time the man tried to say a word. Soon they had Morik on the rack, the torturer giving the wheel a slight, almost imperceptible, except to the agonized Morik, turn every few moments. Meanwhile, Tiernicknick continued to bear the brunt of the torment. When Jarkeld went to him again, the pirate couldn't stand, so the guards pulled him to his feet and held him.
"Ready to tell me the truth?"
Jarkeld asked. Tiernicknick spat in his face.
"Bring the horses!"
the magistrate shrieked, trembling with rage. The crowd went wild. It wasn't often that the magistrate went to the trouble of a drawing and quartering. Those who had witnessed it boasted it was the greatest show of all. Four white horses, each trailing a sturdy rope, were ridden into the square. The crowd was pushed back by the city guard as the horses approached the platform. Magistrate Jarkeld guided his men through the precise movements of the show. Soon, Tiernicknick was securely strapped in place, wrists and ankles bound, one to each horse. On the magistrate's signal, the riders nudged their powerful beasts, one toward each point of the compass. The tattooed pirate instinctively bunched up his muscles, fighting back, but resistance was useless. Tiernicknick was stretched to the limits of his physical coil. He grunted and gasped, and the riders in their well-trained mounts kept him at the very limits. A moment later, there came the loud popping of a shoulder snapping out of joint. Soon after, one of Tiernicknick's knees exploded. Jarkeld motioned for the riders to hold steady, and he walked over to the man, a knife in one hand and a whip in the other. He showed the gleaming blade to the groaning Tiernicknick, rolling it over and over before the man's eyes.
"I can end the agony," the magistrate promised. "Confess your guilt, and I will kill you swiftly."
The tattooed half-Quillen grunted and looked away. On Jarkeld's wave, the riders stepped their horses out a bit more. The man's pelvis shattered, and how he howled at last, how the crowd yelled in appreciation as the skin started to rip.
"Confess!"
Jarkeld yelled.
"I stick him!"
Tiernicknick cried. Before the crowd could even groan its disappointment, Jarkeld yelled,
"Too late!"
and cracked his whip. The horses jumped away, tearing Tiernicknick's legs from his torso. Then the two horses bound to the man's wrists had him out straight, his face twisted in the horror of searing agony and impending death for just an instant before quartering that portion as well. Some gasped, some vomited, and most cheered wildly.
"Justice," Robillard said to the growling, disgusted Dudermont. "Such displays make murder an unpopular profession."
Dudermont snorted.
It merely feeds the basest of human emotions, he argued.
I don't disagree, Robillard replied. I don't make the laws, but unlike your barbarian friend, I abide by them. Are we any more sympathetic to the pirates we catch out on the high seas?
We do as we must, Dudermont argued. We do not torture them to sate our twisted hunger.
But we take satisfaction in sinking them, Robillard countered. We don't cry for their deaths, and often, when we are in pursuit of a companion privateer, we do not stop to pull them from the sharks. Even when we do take them as prisoners, we subsequently drop them at the nearest port, often Luskin, for justice such as this.
Dudermont had run out of arguments, so he just stared ahead. Still, to the civilized and cultured captain's thinking, this display in no way resembled justice. Jarkeld went back to work on Morik and Wolfgar, before the many attendants had even cleared the blood and grime from the square in front of the platform.
"You see how long it took him to admit the truth?"
the magistrate said to Morik.
"Too late! And so he suffered to the end. Will you be as much a fool?"
Morik, whose limbs were beginning to pull past the breaking point, started to reply. Started to confess, but Jarkeld put a finger over the man's lips.
"Now is not the time," he explained.
Morik started to speak again, so Jarkeld had him tightly gagged, a dirty rag stuffed into his mouth, another tied around his head to secure it. The magistrate moved around the back of the rack and produced a small wooden box. The rat box, it was called. The crowd howled its pleasure. Recognizing the horrible instrument, Morik's eyes popped wide and he struggled futilely against the unyielding bonds. He hated rats, had been terrified of them all of his life. His worst nightmare was coming true. Jarkeld came to the front of the platform again and held the box high, turning it slowly so that the crowd could see its ingenious design. The front was a metal mesh cage, the other three walls and the ceiling solid wood. The bottom was wooden as well, but it had a sliding panel that left an exit hole. A rat would be pushed into the box. Then the box would be put on Morik's bared belly and the bottom door removed. Then the box would be lit on fire. The rat would escape through the only means possible, through Morik. A gloved man came out holding the rat and quickly got the boxed creature in place atop Morik's bared belly. He didn't light it then, but rather let the animal walk around, its feet tapping on flesh, every now and then nipping. Morik struggled futilely. Jarkeld went to Wolfgar. Given the level of excitement and enjoyment running through the mob, the magistrate wondered how he would top it all, wondered what he might do to this stoic behemoth that would bring more spectacle than the previous two executions.
"Like what we're doing to your friend Morik?"
the magistrate asked. Wolfgar, who had seen the bowels of Ertu's domain, who had been chewed by creatures that would terrify an army of rats, did not reply.
"They hold you in the highest regard," Robillard remarked to Dudermont. "Rarely has Luskin seen so extravagant a multiple execution."
The words echoed in Captain Dudermont's mind, particularly the first sentence. To think that his standing in Luskin had brought this about. No, it had provided sadistic Jarkeld with an excuse for such treatment of fellow human beings, even guilty ones. Dudermont remained unconvinced that either Wolfgar or Morik had been involved. The realization that this was all done in his honor disgusted Dudermont profoundly.
"Mr. McCanty," he ordered, quickly scribbling a note he handed to the man. "No," Robillard insisted. Understanding what Dudermont had in mind and knowing how greatly such an action would cost Sea Sprite, both with the authorities and the mob. "He deserves death." "Who are you to judge?" Dudermont asked.
"Not I," the wizard protested. "Them," he explained, sweeping his arm out to the crowd.
Dudermont scoffed at the absurd notion.
"Captain, we'll be forced to leave Luskin and will not be welcomed back soon,"
Robillard pointed out. "They will forget as soon as the next prisoners are paraded out for their enjoyment, likely on the morrow's dawn." He gave a wry, humorless smile. "Besides, you don't like Luskin anyway." Robillard groaned, sighed, and threw up his hands in defeat as Dudermont, too civilized a man, gave the note to McCanty and bade him to rush it to the magistrate.
"Light the box!"
Jarkeld called from the stage after the guards had brought Wulfgar around so that the barbarian could witness Morik's horror. Wulfgar could not distance himself from the sight of setting the rat cage on fire. The frightened creature scurried around and then began to burrow. The scene of such pain inflicted on a friend entered into Wulfgar's private domain, clawed through his wall of denial, even as the rat bit through Morik's skin. The barbarian loosed a growl so threatening, so preternaturally feral, that it turned the eyes of those near him from the spectacle of Morik's horror. Huge muscles bunched and flexed, and Wulfgar snapped his torso out to the side, launching the man holding him there away. The barbarian lashed out with one leg, swinging the iron ball and chain so that it wrapped the legs of the other man holding him. A sharp tug sent the guard to the ground. Wulfgar pulled and pulled as others slammed against him, as clubs battered him, as Jarkeld, angered by the distraction, yelled for Morik's gag to be removed. Somehow, incredibly, powerful Wulfgar pulled his arms free and lurched for the rack. Guard after guard slammed into him. He threw them aside as if they were children, but so many rushed the barbarian that he couldn't beat a path to Morik, who was screaming in agony now.
"Get it off me!" cried Morik.
Suddenly Wulfgar was face down. Jarkeld got close enough to snap his whip across the man's back with a loud crack.
"Admit your guilt!"
the frenzied magistrate demanded as he beat Wulfgar viciously. Wulfgar growled and struggled. Another guard tumbled away, and another got his nose splattered all over his face by a heavy slug.
"Get it off me!" Morik cried again.
The crowd loved it. Jarkeld felt certain he'd reached a new level of showmanship.
"Stop!"
came a cry from the audience that managed to penetrate the general howls and hoots.
"Enough!"
The excitement died away fast as the crowd turned and recognized the speaker as Captain Dudermont of Sea Sprite. Dudermont looked haggard and leaned heavily on a cane. Magistrate Jarkeld's trepidation only heightened as Waylon McCanty pushed past the guards to climb onto the stage. He rushed to Jarkeld's side and presented him with Dudermont's note. The magistrate pulled it open and read it. Surprised, stunned even, he grew angrier by the word. Jarkeld looked up at Dudermont, casually motioned for one of the guards to gag the screaming Morik again, and for the others to pull the battered Wulfgar up to his feet. Unconcerned for himself, and with no comprehension of what was happening beyond the torture of Morik, Wulfgar bolted from their grasp. He staggered and tripped over the swinging balls and chains, but managed to dive close enough to reach out and slap the burning box and rat from Morik's belly. He was beaten again and hauled before Jarkeld.
"It will only get worse for Morik now,"
the sadistic magistrate promised quietly, and he turned to Dudermont, a look of outrage clear on his face.
"Captain Dudermont," he called, "as the victim and a recognized nobleman, you have the authority to pen such a note. But are you sure, at this late hour?"
Dudermont came forward, ignoring the grumbles and protests, even threats, and stood tall in the midst of the bloodthirsty crowd.
"The evidence against Creeps Sharkey and the tattooed pirate was solid," he explained. "But plausible, too, is Morik's tale of being set up with Wulfgar to take the blame, while the other two took only the reward."
"But,"
Jarkeld argued, pointing his finger into the air,
"plausible, too, is the tale that Creep Sharkey told, one of conspiracy that makes them all guilty."
The crowd, confused but suspecting that their fun might soon be at an end, seemed to like Magistrate Jarkeld's explanation better.
"And plausible, too, is the tale of Josie Puddles, one that further implicates both Morik the Rogue and Wulfgar,"
Jarkeld went on.
"Might I remind you, Captain, that the barbarian hasn't even denied the claims of Creep Sharkey?"
Dudermont then looked to Wulfgar, who continued his infuriating, expressionless stance.
"Captain Dudermont, do you declare the innocence of this man?"
Jarkeld asked, pointing to Wulfgar and speaking slowly and loudly enough for all to hear.
"That is not within my rights,"
Dudemont replied over the shouts of protest from the bloodthirsty peasants.
"I cannot determine guilt or innocence, but can only offer that which you have before you."
Magistrate Jarkeld stared at the hastily penned note again, then held it up for the crowd to see.
"A letter of pardon for Wulfgar," he explained.
The crowd hushed as one for just an instant, then began jostling and shouting curses. Both Dudemont and Jarkeld feared that a riot would ensue.
"This is folly,"
Jarkeld snarled. "I am a visitor in excellent standing by your own words, Magistrate Jarkeld," Dudemont replied calmly. "By that standing, I ask the city to pardon Wulfgar, and by that standing, I expect you to honor that request or face the questioning of your superiors." There it was, stated flatly, plainly, and without any wiggle room at all. Jarkeld was bound, Dudermont and the magistrate knew, for the captain was indeed well within his rights to offer such a pardon. Such letters were not uncommon, usually given at great expense to the family of the pardoned man, but never before in such a dramatic fashion as this, not at the prisoner's carnival, at the very moment of Jarkeld's greatest show.
"Death to Wulfgar!"
someone in the crowd yelled, and others joined in, while Jarkeld and Dudermont looked to Wulfgar in that critical time. Their expression meant nothing to the man, who still thought that death would be a relief, perhaps the greatest escape possible from his haunting memories. When Wulfgar looked to Morrick, the man stretched to near breaking, his stomach all bloody, and the guards bringing forth another rat, he realized it wasn't an option, not if the rogue's loyalty to him meant anything at all.
"I had nothing to do with the attack,"
Wulfgar flatly declared.
"Believe me if you will. Kill me if you don't. It matters not to me."
"There you have it, Magistrate Jarkeld," Dudermont said. "Release him, if you please. Honor my pardon as a visitor in excellent standing to Luskan."
Jarkeld held Dudermont's stare for a long time. The old man was obviously disapproving, but he nodded to the guards, and Wulfgar was immediately released from their grasp. Tentatively, and only after further prompting from Jarkeld, one of the men brought a key down to Wolfgar's ankles, releasing the ball and chain shackles.
"Get him out of here,"
an angry Jarkeld instructed, but the big man resisted the guards' attempts to pull him from the stage.
"Morrick is innocent,"
Wulfgar declared.
"What?"
Jarkeld exclaimed.
"Drag him away!"
Wulfgar, stronger than the guards could ever imagine, held his ground.
"I proclaim the innocence of Morrick the Rogue," he cried. "He did nothing. And if you continue here, you do so only for your own evil pleasures and not in the name of justice."
"How much you two sound alike," an obviously disgusted Robillard whispered to Dudermont, coming up behind the captain.
"Master Jarkeld,"
the captain called above the cries of the crowd. Jarkeld eyed him directly, knowing what was to come. The captain merely nodded. Scowling, the magistrate snapped up his parchments, waved angrily to his guards, and stormed off the stage. The frenzied crowd started pressing forward, but the city guard held them back. Smiling widely, sticking his tongue out at those peasants who tried to spit at him, Morrick was half-dragged, half-carried from the stage behind Wulfgar. Morrick spent most of the walk through the magistrate offices talking soothingly to Wulfgar. The rogue could tell from the big man's expression that Wulfgar was locked into those awful memories again. Morrick feared that he would tear down the walls and kill half the magistrate's assistants. The rogue's stomach was still bloody, and his arms and legs ached more profoundly than anything he had ever felt. He had no desire to go back to the prisoner's carnival. Morrick thought they would be brought before Jarkeld. That prospect, given Wulfgar's volatile mood, scared him more than a little. To his relief, the escorting guards avoided Jarkeld's office and turned into a small, nondescript room. A nervous little man sat behind a tremendous desk littered with mounds of papers. One of the guards presented Dudermont's note to the man. He took a quick look at it and snorted, for he had already heard of a disappointing show at Prisoner's Carnival. The little man quickly scribbled his initials across the note, confirming that it had been reviewed and accepted.
"You are not innocent," he said, handing the note to Wolfgar, "and thus are not declared innocent."
"We were told that we would be free to go," Morik argued.
"Indeed," said the bureaucrat. "Not really free to go, but rather compelled to go. You were spared because Captain Dudermont apparently had not the heart for your execution. But understand that in the eyes of Luskin, you are guilty of the crime charged. Thus you are banished for life. Straight away to the gate with you. And if you are ever caught in our city again, you'll face Prisoner's Carnival one last time. Even Captain Dudermont will not be able to intervene on your behalf. Do you understand?"
"Not a difficult task," Morik replied. The wormy bureaucrat glared at him, to which Morik only shrugged.
"Get them out of here," the man commanded.
One guard grabbed Morik by the arm, the other reached for Wolfgar, but a shrug and a look from the barbarian had him thinking better of it. Still, Wolfgar went along without argument, and soon the pair were out in the sunshine, unshackled and feeling free for the first time in many days. To their surprise, though, the guards did not leave them there, escorting them all the way to the city's eastern gate.
"Get out, and don't come back,"
one of them said as the gate slammed closed behind them.
"Why would I want to return to your wretched city?" Morik cried, making several lewd and insulting gestures at those soldiers staring down from the wall.
One lifted a crossbow and leveled it Morik's way.
"Looky," he said, "the little rat's already trying to sneak back in."
Morik knew that it was time to leave, and in a hurry. He turned and started to do just that, then looked back to see the soldier, a wary look upon the man's grizzled face, quickly lower the bow. When Morik looked back, he understood, for Captain Dudermont and his wizard sidekick were fast approaching. For a moment, it occurred to Morik that Dudermont might have saved them from Jarkeld only because he desired to exact a punishment of his own. The fear was short-lived, for the man strode right up to Wolfgar, staring hard but making no threatening moves. Wolfgar met his stare, neither blinking nor flinching.
"Did you speak truly?" Dudermont asked.
Wolfgar snorted, and it was obvious it was all the response the captain would get.
"What has happened to Wolfgar, son of Beornigar?" Dudermont said quietly.
Wolfgar turned to go, but the captain rushed around to stand before him.
"You owe me this, at least," he said. "I owe you nothing," Wolfgar replied.
Dudermont considered the response for just a moment, and Morik recognized that the seaman was trying to see things from Wolfgar's point of view.
"Agreed," the captain said, and Robillard huffed in displeasure. "You claimed your innocence. In that case, you owe nothing to me, for I did nothing but what was right. Hear me out of past friendship."
Wolfgar eyed him coldly, but made no immediate move to walk away.
"I don't know what has caused your fall, my friend. What has led you away from companions like Drizdo Urden and Ketty Bree, and your adoptive father, Brunner, who took you in and taught you the ways of the world," the captain said. "I only pray that those three and the halfling are safe and well."
Dudermont paused, but Wolfgar said nothing. "There is no lasting relief in a bottle, my friend," the captain said, "and no heroism in defending a tavern from its customary patrons. Why would you surrender the world you knew for this?" Having heard enough, Wolfgar started to walk away. When the captain stepped in front of him again, the big man just pushed on by without slowing, with Morik scrambling to keep up.
"I offer you passage," Dudermont unexpectedly even to Dudermont, called after him.
"Captain," Robillard protested, but Dudermont brushed him away and scrambled after Wolfgar and Morik.
"Come with me to Sea Sprite," Dudermont said,
Together we shall hunt pirates and secure the Sword Coast for honest sailors. You will find your true self out there, I promise.
I would hear only your definition of me,
Wulfgar clarified, spinning back and hushing Morik, who seemed quite enthralled by the offer.
And that's one I don't care to hear.
Wulfgar turned and started away. Jaw hanging open, Morik watched him go. By the time he turned back, Dudermont had likewise retreated into the city. Robillard, though, held his ground and his sour expression.
Might I?
Morik started to ask, walking toward the wizard. Be gone and be fast about it, rogue, Robillard warned. Else you will become a stain on the ground, awaiting the next rain to wash you away. Clever Morik, the ultimate survivor who hated wizards, didn't have to be told twice. Part 3. A Wild Land Made Wilder.
The course of events in my life have often made me examine the nature of good and evil. I have witnessed the purest forms of both repeatedly, particularly evil. The totality of my early life was spent living among it, a wickedness so thick in the air that it choked me and forced me away. Only recently, as my reputation has begun to gain me some acceptance among the human populations, a tolerance at least, if not a welcome, have I come to witness a more complex version of what I observed in Menzo Berenzon. A shade of gray varying in lightness and darkness. So many humans, it seems, a vast majority, have within their makeup a dark side, a hunger for the macabre, and the ability to dispassionately dismiss the agony of another in pursuit of the self. Nowhere is this more evident than in the prisoners' carnival at Luskin and other such pretenses of justice. Prisoners, sometimes guilty, sometimes not, it hardly matters, are paraded before the blood-hungry mob, then beaten, tortured, and finally executed in grand fashion. The presiding magistrate works very hard to exact the most exquisite screams of the purest agony. His job is to twist the expressions of those prisoners into the epitome of terror, the ultimate horror reflected in their eyes. Once, when in Luskin with Captain Dudermont of the Sea Sprite, I ventured to the carnival to witness the trials of several pirates we had fished from the sea after sinking their ship. Witnessing the spectacle of 1,000 people crammed around a grand stage, yelling and squealing with delight as these miserable pirates were literally cut into pieces, almost made me walk away from Dudermont's ship. Almost made me forego a life as a pirate hunter and retreat to the solitude of the forest or the mountains. Of course, Catti Bree was there to remind me of the truth of it. To point out that these same pirates often exacted equal tortures upon innocent prisoners. While she admitted that such a truth did not justify the prisoners' carnival, Catti Bree was so horrified by the mere thought of the place that she would not go anywhere near it. She argued that such treatment of pirates was preferable to allowing them free run of the high seas. But why? Why any of it? The question has bothered me for all these years, and in seeking its answer, I have come to explore yet another facet of these incredibly complex creatures called humans. Why would common, otherwise decent folk descend to such a level as the spectacle of Prisoner's Carnival? Why would some of the Sea Sprite's own crew, men and women I knew to be honorable and decent, take pleasure in viewing such a macabre display of torture? The answer, perhaps, if there is a more complicated answer than the nature of evil itself, lies in an examination of the attitudes of other races. Among the goodly races, humans alone celebrate the executions and torments of prisoners. Halfling societies would have no part of such a display. Halfling prisoners have been known to die of overeating. Nor would dwarves, as aggressive as they can be. In dwarven society, prisoners are dealt with efficiently and tidily, without spectacle and out of public view.
a murderer among dwarves, would be dealt a single blow to the neck. Never did I see any elves at Prisoner's Carnival, except on one occasion when a pair ventured by, then quickly left, obviously disgusted. My understanding is that in gnome society there are no executions, just a lifetime of imprisonment in an elaborate cell. So why humans? What is it about the emotional construct of the human being that brings about such a spectacle as Prisoner's Carnival? Evil? I think that too simple an answer. Dark elves relish torture. How well I know, and their actions are indeed based on sadism and evil, and an insatiable desire to satisfy the demonic hunger of the Spider Queen. But with humans, as with everything about humans, the answer becomes a bit more complex. Surely there is a measure of sadism involved, particularly on the part of the presiding magistrate and his torturer assistants. But for the common folk, the powerless paupers cheering in the audience, I believe their joy stems from three sources. First, peasants in Faerun are a powerless lot, subjected to the whims of unscrupulous lords and landowners, and with the ever-present threat of some invasion or another by goblins, giants, or fellow humans, stomping flat the lives they have carved. Prisoner's Carnival affords these unfortunate folk a taste of power, the power over life and death. At long last, they feel some sense of control over their own lives. Second, humans are not long-lived like elves and dwarves. Even halflings will usually outlast them. Peasants face the possibility of death daily. A mother fortunate enough to survive two or three births will likely witness the death of at least one of her children. Living so intimately with death obviously breeds a curiosity and fear, even terror. At Prisoner's Carnival, these folk witness death at its most horrible, the worst that death can give, and take solace in the fact that their own deaths, unless they become the accused brought before the magistrates, will not likely be as terrible. I have witnessed your worst grim death, and I fear you not. The third explanation for the appeal of Prisoner's Carnival lies in the necessity of justice and punishment in order to maintain order in a society. This was the side of the debate held up by Robillard the Wizard upon my return to the Sea Sprite after witnessing the horror. While he took no pleasure in viewing the carnival and rarely attended, Robillard defended it as vigorously as I might expect from the magistrate himself. The public humiliation of these men, the public display of their agony, would keep other folk on an honest course, he believed. Thus the cheers of the peasant mob were no more than a rousing affirmation of their belief in the law and order of their society. It is a difficult argument to defeat, particularly concerning the effectiveness of such displays in dissuading future criminals. But is it truly justice? Armed with Robillard's arguments, I went to some minor magistrates in Luskan, on the pretense of deciding better protocol for the Sea Sprite to hand over captured pirates, but in truth, to get them talking about Prisoner's Carnival. It became obvious to me, and very quickly, that the carnival itself had little to do with justice. Many innocent men and women had found their way to the stage in Luskan, forced into false confession by sheer brutality, then punished publicly for those crimes. The magistrates knew this, and readily admitted it by citing their relief that at least the prisoners we brought to them were assuredly guilty. For that reason alone, I can never come to terms with the Prisoner's Carnival. One measure of any society is the way it deals with those who have walked away from the course of community and decency, and an indecent treatment of these criminals decreases the standards of morality to the level of the tortured. Yet the practice continues to thrive in many cities in Faerun, and in many, many rural communities, where justice, as a matter of survival, must be even more harsh and definitive. Perhaps there is a fourth explanation for the carnival. Perhaps the crowds gather around eagerly, merely for the excitement of the show. Perhaps there is no underlying cause or explanation other than the fun of it. I do not like to consider this a possibility, for if humans, on as large a scale are capable of eliminating empathy and sympathy so completely as to actually enjoy the spectacle of watching another suffer horribly, then that, I fear, is the truest definition of evil. After all the hours of investigation, debate, and interrogation, and many, many hours of contemplation on the nature of these humans among whom I live, I am left without simple answers to travesties such as the prisoner's carnival. I am hardly surprised. Rarely do I find a simple answer to anything concerning humans. That, perhaps, is the reason I find little tedium in my day-to-day travels and encounters. That, perhaps, is the reason I have come to love them. Drizzt Do'Urden.
Chapter 14. Stolen Seed. Wulfgar stood outside of Luskin, staring back at the city where he had been wrongly accused, tortured, and publicly humiliated. Despite all of that, the barbarian held no anger toward the folk of the town, even toward the vicious magistrate. If he happened upon Jarkeld, he would likely twist the man's head off, but out of a need for closure on that particular incident and not out of hatred. Wulfgar was past hatred, had been for a long time. As it was when Tree Blockbreaker had come hunting him at the Cutlass and he had killed the man. As it was when he happened upon the Sky Ponies, a barbarian tribe akin to his own. He had taken vengeance upon their wicked shaman, an oath of revenge he had sworn years before. It was not for hatred, not even for unbridled rage, but simply Wulfgar's need to try to push forward in a life where the past was too horrible to contemplate. Wulfgar had come to realize that he wasn't moving forward, and that point seemed obvious to him now as he stared back at the city. He was going in circles, small circles, that left him in the same place over and over, a place made tolerable only through use of the bottle, only by blurring the past into oblivion and putting the future out of mind. Wulfgar spat on the ground, trying for the first time since he had come to Luskin months before to figure out how he had entered this downward spiral. He thought of the open range to the north, his homeland of Icewind Dale, where he had shared such excitement and joy with his friends. He thought of Brunner, who had beaten him in battle when he was but a boy, but had shown him such mercy. The dwarf had taken him in as his own, then brought Drizzt to train him in the true ways of the warrior. What a friend Drizzt had been, leading him on grand adventures, standing by him in any fight, no matter the odds. He'd lost Drizzt. He thought again of Brunner, who had given Wulfgar his greatest achievement in craftsmanship, the wondrous Aegis Fang, the symbol of Brunner's love for him, and now he'd not only lost Brunner, but Aegis Fang as well. He thought of Catti Bree, perhaps the most special of all to him, the woman who had stolen his heart, the woman he admired and respected above all. Perhaps they could not be lovers or husband and wife. Perhaps she would never bear his children. But she was his friend, honest and true. When he thought of their last encounter, he came to understand the truth of that friendship. Catti Bree would have given anything to help him, would have shared with him her most intimate moments and feelings. But Wulfgar understood that her heart was truly for another. The fact didn't bring anger or jealousy to the barbarian. He felt only respect, for despite her feelings, Catti Bree would have given all to help him. Now Catti Bree was lost to him too. Wulfgar spat again. He didn't deserve them, not Brunner, Drizzt, nor Catti Bree. Not even Regis, who, despite his diminutive size and lack of fighting prowess, would leap in front of Wulfgar in time of crisis, would shield the barbarian as much as he could from harm. How could he have thrown all that away? His attention shifted abruptly back to the present as a wagon rolled out of Luskin's western gate. Despite his foul mood, Wulfgar could not hold back a smile as the wagon approached. The driver, a plump elderly woman, came into view. Morik. The two had been banished only days before, but they had hung around the city's perimeter.
The rogue explained that he was going to have to secure some supplies if he was to survive on the open road, so he'd re-entered the city alone. Judging from the way the pair of horses labored, judging from the fact that Morik had a wagon and horses at all, Wolfgar knew his sneaky little friend had succeeded. The rogue turned the wagon off the wide road and onto a small trail that wove into the forest where Wolfgar waited. He came right up to the bottom of the bluff where Wolfgar sat, then stood up and bowed. "Not so difficult a thing," he announced.
"The guards didn't notice you?"
Wolfgar asked. Morik snorted, as if the notion were preposterous. "They were the same guards as when we were escorted out," he explained, his tone full of pride. Their experience at the hands of Luskin's authorities had reminded Wolfgar that he and Morik were just big players in a small pond, insignificant when measured against the larger pond that was the backdrop of the huge city. But what a large player Morik was in their small corner. "I even lost a bag of food at the gate," Morik went on. "One of the guards ran to catch up to me so that he could replace it on the wagon." Wolfgar moved down the bluff to the side of the wagon and pulled aside the canvas that covered the load. There were bags of food at the back, along with rope and material for shelter, but most prominent to Wolfgar's sensibilities were the cases of bottles, full bottles of potent liquor. "I thought you would be pleased," Morik remarked, moving beside the big man as he stared at the hall. "Leaving the city doesn't have to mean leaving our pleasures behind. I was thinking of dragging Deli Curti along as well." Wolfgar snapped an angry glare at Morik. The mention of the woman in such a lewd manner profoundly offended him. "Come," Morik said, clearing his throat and obviously changing the subject. "Let us find a quiet place where we may quench our thirst." The rogue pulled off his disguise slowly, wincing at the pain that still permeated his joints and his ripped stomach. Those wounds, particularly in his knees, would be slow to heal. He paused again a moment later, holding up the wig to admire his handiwork, then climbed onto the driving bench, taking the reins in hand.
"The horses are not so fine," Wolfgar noted.
The team seemed an old, haggard pair.
"I needed the gold to buy the drink," Morik explained.
Wolfgar glanced back at the load, thinking that Morik should have spent the funds on a better team of horses, thinking that his days in the bottle had come to an end. He started up the bluff again, but Morik stopped him with a call.
"There are bandits on the road," the rogue announced. "Or so I was informed in town. Bandits on the road north of the forest and all the way to the pass through the spine of the world."
"You fear bandits?"
Wolfgar asked, surprised.
"Only ones have never heard of me," Morik explained,
and Wolfgar understood the deeper implications. In Luskin, Morik's reputation served him well by keeping most thugs at bay.
"Better that we are prepared for trouble," the rogue finished.
Morik reached under the driver's bench and produced a huge axe.
"Look," he said with a grin, obviously quite proud of himself as he pointed to the axe head. "It's still stained with Creep's Sharky's blood."
The headman's own axe. Wolfgar started to ask Morik how in the nine hells he'd managed to get his hands on that weapon, but decided he simply didn't want to know.
"Come along,"
Morik instructed, patting the bench beside him. The rogue pulled a bottle from the closest case.
"Let's ride and drink, and plot our defense."
Wolfgar stared long and hard at that bottle before climbing onto the bench. Morik offered him the bottle, but he declined with gritted teeth. Shrugging, the rogue took a healthy swallow and offered it again. Again Wolfgar declined. That brought a puzzled look to Morik's face, but it fast turned into a smile, as he decided that Wolfgar's refusal would leave more for him.
"We needn't live like savages just because we're on the road," Morik stated.
The irony of that statement from a man guzzling so potent a drink was not lost on Wolfgar. The barbarian managed to resist the bottle throughout the afternoon, and Morik happily drained it. Keeping the wagon at a swift pace, Morik tossed the empty bottle against a rock as they passed, then howled with delight when it shattered into 1,000 pieces.
"You make a lot of noise for one trying to avoid highwaymen," Wolfgar grumbled.
"Avoid?" Morik asked with a snap of his fingers. "Hardly that. Highwaymen often have well-equipped campsites where we might find some comfort."
"Such well-equipped campsites must belong to successful highwaymen," Wolfgar reasoned. "And successful highwaymen are likely very good at what they do."
"As was Tree Blockbreaker, my friend," Morik reminded.
When Wolfgar still didn't seem convinced, he added,
"Perhaps they will accept our offer to join with them."
"I think not," said Wolfgar.
Morik shrugged, then nodded.
"Then we must chase them off," he said matter-of-factly.
"We'll not even find them," Wolfgar muttered.
"Oh?" Morik asked. And he turned the wagon down a side trail so suddenly that it went up on 2 wheels and Wolfgar nearly tumbled off.
"What?"
the barbarian grumbled as they bounced along. He just barely ducked a low branch, then got a nasty scratch as another whipped against his arm.
"Morik!"
"Quiet, my large friend," the rogue said. "There's a river up ahead with but one bridge across it. A bridge bandits would no doubt guard well." They burst out of the brush, bouncing to the banks of the river. Morik slowed the tired horses to a walk, and they started across a rickety bridge. To the rogue's dismay, they crossed safely with no bandits in sight.
"Novices?"
a disappointed Morik grumbled, vowing to go a few miles, then turn back and cross the bridge again. Morik abruptly stopped the wagon. A large and ugly man stepped onto the road up ahead, pointing a sword their way.
"How interesting that such a pair as yourselves should be walking in my woods without my permission,"
the thug remarked, bringing the sword back and dropping it across his shoulder.
"Your woods?" Morik asked.
"Why, good sir, I had thought this forest open for travel."
Under his breath to Wolfgar, he added, "Half-orc."
"Idiot," Wolfgar replied so that only Morik could hear. "You, I mean, and not the thief, to look for this trouble."
"I thought it would appeal to your heroic side," the rogue replied. "Besides, this highwayman has a camp filled with comforts, no doubt."
"What are you talking about?" the thug demanded.
"Why, you, good sir," Morik promptly replied. "My friend here was just saying that he thought you might be a thief, and that you do not own this forest at all."
The bandit's eyes widened, and he stuttered over several responses unsuccessfully. He wound up spitting on the ground.
"I'm saying it's my wood," he declared, poking his chest. "Togo's wood."
"And the cost of passage through, good Togo?" Morik asked.
5 gold,
the thug cried, and after a pause he added,
"Each of you."
"Give it to him," Wolfgar muttered.
Morik chuckled, then an arrow zipped past, barely an inch in front of his face.
Surprised that this band was so well organized, the rogue abruptly changed his mind and started reaching for his purse. However, Wolfgar had changed his mind as well, enraged that someone had nearly killed him. Before Morik could agree on the price, the barbarian leaped from the wagon and rushed at Togo barehanded, then suddenly changed his mind and direction. A pair of arrows cut across his initial path. He turned for the monstrous archer he'd spotted, perched high in a tree 12 feet back from the road. Wolfgar crashed through the first line of brush and slammed hard into a fallen log. Hardly slowing, he lifted the log and threw it into the face of another crouching human, then continued his charge. He made it to the base of the tree just as an arrow thunked into the ground beside him, a near miss Wolfgar ignored. Leaping to a low branch, he caught hold and hauled himself upward with tremendous strength and agility, nearly running up it. Bashing back small branches, scrambling over others, he came level with the archer. The creature, a gnoll bigger than Wolfgar, was desperately trying to set another arrow.
"Keep it!"
the cowardly gnoll yelled, throwing the bow at Wolfgar and stepping off the branch, preferring the 20-foot drop to Wolfgar's rage. Escape wasn't that easy for the gnoll. Wolfgar thrust out a hand and caught the falling creature by the collar. Despite all the wriggling and punching, the awkward position and the gnoll's weight, Wolfgar had no trouble hauling it up. Then he heard Morik's cry for help. Standing on the driver's bench, the rogue worked furiously with his slender sword to fend off the attacks from both Togo and another human swordsman who had come out from the brush. Worse, he heard a third approaching from behind, and worse still, arrows regularly cut the air nearby. "I'll pay," he cried, but the monstrous thugs only laughed. Out of the corner of his eye, Morik spotted an archer taking aim. He leaped backward as the missile came on, dodging both it and the thrust from the surprisingly deft swordsman in front of him. The move cost him, though, for he tumbled over the back of the bench, crashing into a case of bottles, shattering them. Morik leaped up and shrieked his outrage, smashing his sword impotently across the chair back. On came Togo, gaining the bench position, but angry Morik matched his movements, coming ahead powerfully without regard for the other swordsmen or archers. Togo retracted his arm for a swing, but Morik, quick with the blade, stabbed first, scoring a hit on Togo's hand that cost the thug his grip. Even as Togo's sword clanged against the wooden bench, Morik closed in, turning his sword out to fend off the attacks from Togo's partner. He produced a dagger from his belt, a blade he promptly and repeatedly drove into Togo's belly. The half-orc tried desperately to fend off the attacks, using his bare hands, but Morik was too quick and too clever, stabbing around them even as his sword worked circles around Togo's partner's blade. Togo fell back from the bench to the ground. He managed only a single running step before he collapsed, clutching his torn guts. Morik heard the third attacker coming in around the side of the wagon. He heard a terrified scream from above, then another from the approaching enemy. The rogue glanced that way just in time to see Wolfgar's captured gnoll archer flying down from on high, arms flailing, screaming all the way. The humanoid missile hit the third thug, a small human woman, squarely, smashing both hard against the wagon in a heap. Groaning, the woman began trying to crawl away. The archer lay very still. Morik pressed the attack on the remaining swordsman, as much to get down from the open driver's bench as to continue the fight. The swordsman, though, apparently had little heart remaining in the battle, with his friends falling all around him. He parried Morik's thrust, backing all the while as the man leaped down to the road. On Morik came, his sword working the thug's blade over and under. He thrust ahead and retracted quickly when the swordsman blocked, then came forward after a subtle roll of his slender sword that disengaged the thug's blade. Staggering, the man retreated, blood running from one shoulder. He started to turn and flee, but Morik kept pace, forcing him to work defensively. Morik heard another cry of alarm behind him, followed by the crack of breaking branches. He smiled with the knowledge that Wolfgar continued to clear out the archers.
"Please, mister,"
Morik's prey grunted, as more and more of the rogue's attacks slipped through with stinging results, and it became clear that Morik was the superior swordsman.
"We was just needing your coin."
"Then you wouldn't have harmed me and my friend after you took our coin?" Morik asked cynically. The man shook his head vigorously, and Morik used the distraction to slip through yet again, drawing a line of red on the man's cheek. Morik's prey fell to his knees with a yelp and tossed his sword to the ground, begging for mercy. "I am known as a merciful sort," Morik said with mock sympathy, hearing Wolfgar approaching fast. "But my friend, I fear, is not." Wolfgar stormed by and grabbed the kneeling man by the throat, hoisting him into the air and running him back into a tree. With one arm, the other tucked defensively with a broken arrow shaft protruding from his shoulder, Wolfgar held the highwayman by the throat off the ground, choking the life out of him. "I could stop him," Morik explained, walking over and putting his hand on his huge friend's bulging forearm. Only then did he notice Wolfgar's serious wound. "You must lead us to your camp."
"No camp," the man gasped.
Wolfgar pressed and twisted.
I will,
the thug squealed, his voice going away as Wolfgar tightened his grip, choking all sounds and all air. his face locked in an expression of the purest rage, the barbarian pressed on.
"Let him go," Morik said. No answer.
The man in Wolfgar's grasp wriggled and slapped, but could neither break the hold nor draw breath.
"Wolfgar!"
Morik called, and he grabbed at the big man's arm with both hands tugging fiercely.
"Snap out of it, man!"
Wolfgar wasn't hearing any of it, didn't even seem to notice the rogue.
"You will thank me for this," Morik vowed,
though he was not so sure as he balled up his fist and smashed Wolfgar on the side of the head. Wolfgar did let go of the thug, who slumped unconscious at the base of the tree, but only to backhand Morik, a blow that sent the rogue staggering backward with Wolfgar coming in pursuit. Morik lifted his sword, ready to plunge it through the big man's heart if necessary. But at the last moment, Wolfgar stopped, blinking repeatedly as if he had just come awake. Morik recognized that Wolfgar had returned from wherever he had gone to this time and place.
"He'll take us to the camp now," the rogue said.
Wolfgar nodded dumbly, his gaze still foggy. He looked dispassionately at the broken arrow shaft poking from his wounded shoulder. The barbarian blanched, looked to Morik in amazement, then collapsed face down in the dirt. Wolfgar awoke in the back of the wagon on the edge of a field lined by towering pines. He lifted his head with some effort and nearly panicked. A woman walking past was one of the thugs from the road. What happened? Had they lost? Before full panic set in, though, he heard Morik's light-hearted voice, and he forced himself up higher, wincing with pain as he put some weight on his injured arm. Wolfgar looked at that shoulder curiously. The arrow shaft was gone, the wound cleaned and dressed. Morik sat a short distance away, chatting amiably and sharing a bottle with another of the Knoll highwaymen, as if they were old friends. Wolfgar slid to the end of the wagon and rolled his legs over, climbing unsteadily to his feet. The world swam before his eyes, black spots crossing his field of vision. The feeling passed quickly, though, and Wolfgar gingerly but deliberately made his way over to Morik.
"Ah, you're awake. A drink, my friend," the rogue said, holding out the bottle.
Frowning, Wolfgar shook his head.
"Come now, ye gots to be drinkin',"
the dog-faced Knoll sitting next to Morik slurred. He spooned a glob of thick stew into his mouth, half of it falling to the ground or down the front of his tunic. Wolfgar glared at Morik's wretched new comrade.
"Rest easy, my friend,"
Morik said, recognizing that dangerous look.
"Mickers here is a friend, and a loyal one now that Togo is dead."
"Send him away,"
Wolfgar said, and the Knoll dropped his jaw in surprise. Morik came up fast, moving to Wolfgar's side and taking him by the good arm. "They are allies," he explained, "all of them. They were loyal to Togo, and now they are loyal to me and to you."
"Send them away," Wolfgar repeated fiercely.
"We're out on the road," Morik argued. "We need eyes, scouts to survey potential territory, and swords to help us hold it fast."
"No,"
Wolfgar said flatly. "You don't understand the dangers, my friend," Morik said reasonably, hoping to pacify his large friend.
"Send them away,"
Wolfgar yelled suddenly. Seeing he'd made no progress with Morik, he stormed up to Mickers.
"Begone from here and from this forest."
Mickers looked past the big man. Morik gave a resigned shrug. Mickers stood up.
"I'll stay with him,"
he said, pointing to the rogue. Wolfgar slapped the stew bowl from the Knoll's hand and grabbed the front of his shirt, pulling him up to his tiptoes.
"One last chance to leave of your own accord,"
the big man growled as he shoved Mickers back several steps.
"Mr. Morik,"
Mickers complained. "Oh, be gone," Morik said unhappily.
"And the rest of us, too?"
asked another one of the humans of the bandit band, sitting amidst a tumble of rocks on the edge of the field. He held a strung bow.
"Them or me, Morik,"
Wolfgar said, his tone leaving no room for debate.
The barbarian and the rogue both glanced back to the archer to see that the man had put an arrow to his bowstring. Wolfgar's eyes flared with simmering rage, and he started toward the archer.
"One shot," he called steadily. "You will get one shot at me. Will you hit the mark?"
The archer lifted his bow.
"I don't think you will," Wolfgar said, smiling. "No. You will miss because you know."
"Know what?" the archer dared ask.
"Know that even if your arrow strikes me, it will not kill me," Wolfgar replied, and he continued his deliberate stalk. "Not right away. Not before I get my hands around your throat."
The man drew his bowstring back, but Wolfgar only smiled more confidently and continued forward. The archer glanced around nervously, looking for support, but there was none to be found.